If you followed us from another podcast to this one, this may not come as quite as big of a shock to you, but if you've only ever listened to us on Death Watch, the sound of this episode might be a little strange. Not as strange as it could be. We're in a hotel room and not, say, a cafe or an open park in the middle of a windstorm.
Hey, you got any butter?
However, we are doing an on-the-road episode of the Death Watch podcast.
Pardon me, gentlemen. Have you got butter?
You guys got any butter? My name is Matt Brown.
I'm Matthew Price. Yeah, we're doing a show.
Yep.
And, you know, this is a little out of our normal range of past celebrities that we wanted to talk about.
Sure, yeah.
We did think it was sort of a good, opportune time. It's the 20th anniversary of Ebert Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And,
but it's also the fifth anniversary
of
Ebert's death.
Right, and we thought, let's talk about the critic of record for the United States and perhaps the world.
Yep.
Roger Ebert.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that he would have expected that for most of his life, but certainly towards the last 10 years, it became clear that, yeah, like, two things became clear, I think. One, and maybe we can discuss this as the show goes on, but one, film criticism itself is on its way down. It was declining possibly to death.
As a cultural signifier,
And then two, possibly because of just longevity, and also possibly because, you know, some of the things that I do want to talk about today, which is the way his style was accessible beyond a fault. Ebert became, like you said, the critic of record. Like, when you think of a film critic, you don't think of Pauline Kael, you don't think of Sarris. You don't even think of Siskel and Ebert anymore. You think of Roger Ebert, who just for, you know, the better part of 50 years just sat there banging out reviews of films and doing it in remarkably concise, remarkably punchy, humanist prose style. That really, you know, he never put a film over somebody's head. He never assumed his audience was too stupid to understand what was going on. He had a very significant impact on that form of writing. And as people here at the festival are fond of saying, and as I'm generally inclined to agree, I think he had an impact on film itself. I think he had a pretty wide reach on what movies got made, how they got made, how they got received, how people found them and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think certainly in the finding and encouraging department.
Yeah.
There are, you know, there's no end to the list of movies that maybe they would have gotten made, but no one would have seen them.
Yeah.
If he hadn't seen them and loved them early enough.
Yeah. So, yeah. Absolutely.
And that, you know, and this idea that getting a good review from him was the actual mark that you had made a good movie.
For sure.
For some, you know, that there are filmmakers for whom that was the achievement.
Well, especially the younger ones. You know, if you grow up reading his work or seeing him on TV with Siskel, there's this cultural capital around him. And of course, like, I mean, I wanted to be a filmmaker myself. Any young filmmaker would think to themselves, man, what is it going to be like if I get any review from Roger Ebert? Good, bad, indifferent. Like, can you imagine if Roger Ebert writes about your movie? So this will be a bit of a looser episode than our normal episodes. But that said, let's do some of the tight stuff right off the top. This episode's dropping on April 27th, 2018. It is of course hosted at the Modern Superior Network, and you can support the Modern Superior Network through the Patreon at patreon.com/modernsuperior. You can follow us on Twitter at DeathWatchPod. So, would you like to do roll call?
Roll call. Roll call.
Yeah.
Here comes roll call.
All right. Hit us with
for those of you new to the show.
Yep.
Generally what we like to do is since the last episode.
Yeah.
Here is the list of people who we have unfortunately lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I just go in the order with which we lost them. There is no
sure.
Most important, least important here. I'm not trying to elevate one person over another. Any loss is a great loss. This is just who happened temporally in this. So what I'm saying is...
Yes.
Now,
thank
if you
Father.
Follow me,
yeah.
All right. So let's start at the beginning. So Dushan Monique Brown, who was an actress and a star on Chicago Fire.
Okay.
We lost her in apparently quite young, like in her 40s. H. Wayne Huizenga.
Eh?
The co-founder and CEO of Blockbuster Video.
Wow.
And also actual trash person. Meaning most of his money was made in garbage collection before he ran Blockbuster.
Gotcha.
Lawrence K. Grossman, who was the head of PBS and the creator of the McNeil-Lehrer Report. Oleg Tabakov, a Russian actor and teacher, made over 100 films, of which I've heard of exactly none of them. But Charles P. Lazarus, who was the founder of Toys R Us. Also, Toys R Us.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
When you go to the toy, I mean, I'll digress for a second because as some of our listeners may already know, I'm a toy collector. And when you go to the Toys R Us Canada website, a modal pops up and says, "We're still here.
Yeah.
It's business as usual. You can still get toys from us." But I can't imagine that that's a long-term scenario. I think
We're
going to lose Toys R Us.
We did. We lost Charles Lazarus, and now we lost Toys R Us.
But Charles Lazarus will come back.
If he's not back already.
Yeah, we'll exactly.
Yeah. Larry Kwong, first Asian professional hockey player.
All right.
And like over 50 years ago, no less.
Copy that.
Jose Antonio Abreu, the Venezuelan music education pioneer who created El Sistema, which has taught over 3 million kids how to play music.
Wow.
Is the most influential and successful music education program ever created. Andy Lewis, who was a screenwriter, wrote Clute, among many other films.
Clute.
We lost him. Linda Brown, who was the little girl in Brown versus Board of Education, died at the in her late 60s. The original Bozo the Clown died this month. Also, Stacey Dash's run at Congress, also dead, as of she had to drop out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy about that. I don't know how you feel about Stacey Dash.
Sure.
Debbie Lee Carrington, actress, little person, prostitute in Total Recall.
Oh,
yeah.
She died?
She died, yeah.
Oh.
Dolores Taylor, who was the female lead in the Billy Jack movies.
Mm-hmm.
Stefano Drin, Stephen Bochco.
Yeah.
A big one. And then right after Bochco, Winnie Mandela. And then Isao Takahata.
Yeah.
Director, Grave of the Fireflies,
yep.
Pompoko. Susan Ansbach, actress. She was in Hair, Five Easy Pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Soon Tak Oh, who was an Asian actor. He was in the original production of Pacific Overtures. He was in Logan's Run. Most importantly, he played Mulan's dad.
Right.
Who else died? Oh, The Simpsons. The Simpsons died.
oh, boy. Did they ever.
Yeah. Chuck McCann, kid show host, character actor, been in hundreds of things, hosted a show in the New York and New Jersey area for kids, kind of like Captain Kangaroo. So, Ralph Woolsey, who was the cinematographer on the Batman TV series in the 60s.
Right on.
So that is significant, I think. He actually created that style with
a look,
Mitzi Shore, owner and president of the Comedy Store, so now Pauly Shore is an orphan. It's strange to think about. Milos Forman,
yes.
Art Bell, conspiracy theory radio host. If you've never dialed up an Art Bell episode off of YouTube or whatever, do that.
I can't say that I have.
He would take calls from kooks. It's the greatest. David S. Buckle. So this is fascinating to me. So we lost this guy, David S. Buckle. He was a lawyer, a well-known defender of queer rights, and then went on to defend environmental rights in protest over our addiction to fossil fuels, self-immolated.
Wow.
In Central Park.
When the fuck was that?
This month.
Ay, ay, ay.
Lit himself on fire with a note that was like, "You've got to get off of gasoline. Now I'm going to prove it." Tim O'Connor, character actor from Peyton Place, many other things. Also, all popular music. Beyonce killed that shit. Dead. She destroyed music. If you've seen Coachella, go download that. Amazing. Arlie Ermey, we lost him. Harry Anderson.
Yeah, that was this week.
We're getting right up to current. Yeah. Barbara Bush. Carl Cassell, who was the announcer on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the popular PBS podcast game show.
Wow.
Current Affairs. David Edgerton, co-founder of Burger King. And this is, his body is going to be cremated, then stored securely, then reheated in a microwave, and then it's going to have grill marks artificially painted on it. Nothing? I get nothing from you? That, just silence.
But, okay.
Come on. It's Burger King.
Yeah, it's Burger King. I got it. Right. That's the Dave from the ads? Dave Edgerton? Is that
No, Dave is from Wendy's.
Oh, Dave's from Wendy's. Yeah. All right.
And lastly, just I think like a couple days ago, Bruno Sammartino, the wrestler.
All right.
So that is your roll call.
Wow.
For this month.
Yeah, this was a bummer month. There were some big names.
There really were. List. Arlie Ermey and Botchko.
I was really excited about doing a Botchko episode. Which may yet happen later in the year, but a few people have preempted. I no point not announcing it now. We're gonna do Isao Takahata for May. So that'll be our next episode after this one, and we'll be back in the studio for that. We are recording this one on the road because we went on a little Death Watch road trip. Or as I realized on Twitter yesterday, wrote R.I.P. doesn't really work as a spoken word piece. But yeah.
I generously laughed at that, but you gave my Burger King joke a clean miss.
Here's the thing. It wasn't good.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've been coming to Ebert Fest, which we might as well tell people what it is, since everybody I told that I was coming here was like, what the fuck are you talking about? So, Roger Ebert used to have this film festival when he was alive, obviously, which started out as the Overlooked Film Festival here in Champaign, Illinois.
Started out, actually, the year before that as the birthday for Hal, the computer.
Oh, all right, fair enough. But the original concept was Roger Ebert's going to show you some movies that maybe you didn't get a chance to see or maybe didn't get a lot of recognition when they were out the first time. And then it sort of just transformed into the Roger Ebert Film Festival, where he just sort of brought films through that were he thought were of note or that were worth seeing for any reason.
And filmmakers, because he would bring... It was sometimes incidental which film, but it was like he really wanted to bring Werner Herzog here, so he did.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. So that all happened. The first year we came was actually the last year he attended because he died shortly before the 2013 edition, so we were here the first time in 2012, which was the last time he was here, and we've been a few times since then.
Yeah.
And it's obviously carried on with his wife running it, with Nate Cohn, who was the other festival director when Ebert was alive. And, you know, they just descend on this small town, which was Ebert's birthplace, and do this film festival.
And they work very closely with the University of Illinois to put it on.
Yeah.
And so there's lots of focus on, you know, film professorship and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it really is a neat, like almost symposium-like way to look at films, because like you said, they always bring guests, so every movie is preceded by an introduction, just followed almost always by a Q&A, and I like the rhythm of the thing. Like, it's three movies a day in a single-screen movie theater, so you basically, you know, you're in the place the whole day. It's not like other festivals where you might have to jog around between venues or, you know, choose in between things. Like, it's a single-venue programming stream. It's 12 films end-to-end. And, you know, usually of very high quality. We've certainly had some spectacular experiences so far this year. We're recording this on the Friday night. Saw Interstellar for the second time in my life. Liked it for the first time in my life. Saw Belle last night with Ama Asante presenting. She's incredibly impressive. That movie is very impressive. This morning we saw Columbus by Kogonada. He was here.
Which is
just a hell of a
incredibly
film.
Incredibly good. Yeah. And, you know, and opened this festival on Thursday night with the screening of The
Fugitive.
And there is, you know, and the festival has a tradition of kind of having a real sort of crowd pleaser, well-known mm-hmm. film as the opener.
Yeah.
And every time it's a great idea.
Yeah.
This is it's a big, big screen
mm-hmm.
and a big, old, grand house.
Yeah.
And, boy, there's just no better way.
Yep.
You know, to really get back into something great.
Yeah, absolutely. When we're here or when we've been here in the past, you know, you mentioned to someone that we're from Toronto, and many of them will say that they're envious, and they should be. I mean, Toronto's a great city for film going. We have a lot of great film festivals. We have a lot of great theaters. What we do not have is anything resembling the Virginia Theater. which, you know, is the kind of place that we used to have in Toronto, like 25 right. years ago, like, right. the, you know, the University, the York, the Eglinton, they used to be those things, the single screen, big, wide houses.
Yeah, anything we have has so long ago been converted to a live
theater. Yeah, house, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the Elgin and Winter Garden mm-hmm. and whatever. And, you know, that once you convert to fully to live, big production theater, you can't really go back to movies. It's very hard to get it set up yeah. properly.
Right.
It always feels a little strange.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. So that's one of the major parts of the appeal is getting to come here and see movies in a venue that is just not like anything I have access to back at home. We should talk. So, you know, I'll give the high level overview of the biography of Roger Ebert.
Please.
But good Lord, even just going in to do the research, you realize the guy just did fucking everything.
He lived a life.
He really lived a life. So there are, here are what I consider to be, and you can tell me if I miss anything, here are what I consider to be the major peaks and valleys for Roger Ebert. Let's start with, he writes his first professional review for the Chicago Sun-Times in 1967. According to his own memoirs, he didn't particularly have any bias towards going into film reviewing when he started. He just wanted
to work. Right, he was a reporter.
Yeah, he wanted to work in newspapers. He'd worked
He'd been a sports writer.
Illini at the university. He'd been a sports writer. He goes in and he starts writing. His first review was of a film called Gallia, and it begins like so. I copied this out.
Oh, there we go.
George Lautner's Gallia opens and closes with arty shots of the ocean, mother of us all, but in between, it's pretty clear that what is washing ashore is the French New Wave. Again, there's that Midwestern style of just sort of rat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat, you know, just, and it's very, even that, like, in that moment, he is writing exactly the same way he would be writing 30 years later.
Yeah.
You know, that's really remarkable to me, because as someone whose own writing style is significantly changed, even in just 10-15 years, I'm really impressed with how clearly his voice comes through. So he's writing reviews for the Chicago Sun-Times. The next major thing is Siskel and Ebert, which starts as sneak previews in 75 as a local station movie review show.
Yep.
Gets syndication.
Gets picked up.
Gets picked up for syndication and becomes huge.
Well, stays as sneak previews for many years on PBS, but yep. goes national.
Yeah.
The Siskel and Ebert at the movies is when they went away from public television.
Right. Yeah. Becomes enormous. And this is the thing that I guess, you know, I was hinting at earlier, which is there was an incredibly long period of my life, yours as well, I'm assuming, where it was basically impossible to picture Siskel and Ebert apart. They were a unit. Siskel and Ebert was a team. They were a brand. The thing that's crazy to me about my adult life is that, you know, Siskel dies very young in 99. Ebert went on to have an entire continued leg of his career where he completely defined himself without Siskel. And that entire, I don't know, image that I have of the two of them together, while still obviously very significant,
it's not actually his.
Yeah, it's not actually.
And that's astounding because,
yeah,
they were so inextricably linked.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think also the thing that's so remarkable about them together as a unit
mm-hmm.
is their actual genuine dislike for each other
mm-hmm.
through most of that,
a lot of it,
cohesive unit.
Yeah,
you know, it eventually grew into great affection.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any question that, you know, there was genuine loss felt when Siskel became ill and passed away first. But there's ample evidence
mm-hmm.
that those guys did not pal around outside of the show.
Mm-hmm.
They would show up with their reviews in hand. They did not talk to each other ahead of time. It was amazing
mm-hmm.
to watch their genuine disagreements on that show and realize, oh, these guys actually, they don't like each other some of the time.
I mean, Ebert would go on to, and I mean, obviously, you know, having outlived Siskel, he can write the nostalgic version of the history however he wants. He went on to kind of describe it as basically being like brothers. Like, yeah, they fought all the time, and there were a lot of things they didn't really agree on, and they were kind of more artificially bonded, like brothers are, than friends. You know, like that's a fair way to put it. One of my favorite things about that Ebert ever did, aside from my own personal biases, he gave The Phantom Menace a 4-star review, which on Roger Ebert's website, 4 is the top. It's 4, he did 4-star reviews in general. He gave it a 4-star review, and even he would admit, you know, he never walked that back, but he was like, Siskel died like 3 months before this movie came out. He was really looking forward to it. I was really looking forward to seeing what he thought of it, and I think he would have liked it. You know, so that's why he gave it this extremely generous review, which obviously for a lot of people, they thought he just lost his fucking mind or something like that. I tend to agree with him. I'm like, you know, I think if you go into that movie looking for what that movie's trying to do, you're going to enjoy it. But I always really like the fact that he basically copped to, you know, I gave this movie a very positive review because my friend would have liked it. You know,
and that was good enough for me.
Yeah, that meant something to me.
Yeah.
So that's Ebert. I mean, sorry, that's Siskel and Ebert. Then you got Chaz. Meets Chaz. Chaz, he marries in 1992. She has become a huge part of the Ebert universe now in those years since they married. Now she runs the Ebert Fest with Nick Cohn.
She runs RogerEbert.com.
RogerEbert.com. And she obviously, like after he literally lost his voice in the illness, she became sort of his voice and his personality during the illness period. So she became a very visible part of all of that. And then in the middle of all this as well, he founds Ebert Fest, as we said, in 1999. Here in Champaign, Illinois, and its 20th edition was this year. It's also worth mentioning that he was a huge supporter of our film festival in Toronto. He considered TIFF to be a major event.
He was probably the first
critic to
really get it.
Yep.
Really get why it was so powerful. He coined this granola bar brigade phrase to sort of describe the people that were hardcore going to films all day.
Yep.
And he was very visible at that festival in public screenings, showing up places.
And right up to the end. Like I met him in 2012 at his book signing, which was at the film festival, which again was like 6 or 7 months shy of his death.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, he was always here for that, you know, you would see him around. He's the first film critic to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And his final review was a 3.5-star review of the Terrence Malick film To the Wonder. So that's the career of Roger Ebert in a nutshell. So, as we do on this show, we both watched films. You chose to watch Willow.
I chose to watch Willow.
Yeah. Had you not seen Willow before?
I had seen Willow before.
Yeah, I thought so.
But it was quite a long time ago. It was when it came out. I have not seen it since.
Yep.
I had basically forgotten it. The only thing I really remembered was the Ebersisk, which is why the monster in the movie is named...
There is a two-headed
monster. There's a two-headed dragon, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The ugliest dragon I think I've ever seen on screen. Like, it's really gross.
It's, not appealing.
And it is called the Ebersisk because the heads are...
Yeah.
So what I wanted to watch it because I think of all the sort of filmmakers or creatives that brushed up against Ebert in essentially a pretty negative way, I would say Lucas was the one who, you know, there's a reason they named the big bad monster the Ebersisk.
And it's also worth noting that the other villain
is Saris.
It's General Kale.
Oh, Kale, right, General Kale. Yeah.
So I was thinking about this when you said you were going to watch it, and that thing, the funniest thing about George Lucas is his persistent belief that critics were terrible to him when they never were.
Right, exactly.
They were never terrible.
No, exactly.
You know, the fact that by 88 he had developed this just animus towards film critics.
Yeah, because
who had supported every move he had ever made.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and that's really what weird. I find, that's what the reason I wanted to watch it is because it's a movie, that in part is sort of saying like, haha, we're making fun of film critics, isn't that fun? But really, actually, we're really actually mad at them.
Yeah.
And, it's an interesting film to hang that on because it's not like a really good movie.
I don't agree, but okay.
It's good. Yeah. It's got some nice points, but it also has, you know, it's a little sloppy in its mythology and it's not quite super well thought out. The rules of the fantasy world are not actually very well sort of constructed. It is very charming.
Yes.
I would say, you know, incredibly, as charming as any of the Indiana Jones films. Like, it has its own kind of, there is a definitely like a super charm in the performances. Yeah. And I think the actor playing Willow is great. Yeah. He's terrific.
Warwick Davis. And he was like 15, 16 years old.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
And he's playing someone who's, you know, probably 30, 35. Yeah. And he's terrific in it.
Yeah. And one of the things that I, you know, when the announcement was made that Ron Howard was taking over the solo movie, one of the things I did say was, well, I mean, Ron Howard is the only person who has made a passable fake Han Solo movie before.
Right.
Because I think Matt Mardigan, played by Val Kilmer in this, is about as close as you can get in the charm
factor. To Han Solo. Yeah.
To Han Solo. So, you know.
And not just in the charm factor, but in the failure by, failure.
By repeated failure.
Yeah. He keeps screwing up in ways that only lead to more success.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. I think,
absolutely. And the other, you know, I was a huge fan of Willow when I was a kid, and I didn't really watch it for a while, like maybe like from like 1995 until about 2015. And then I watched it, and in between, obviously, the Lord of the Rings trilogy had happened, and so we all became very familiar with the look and feel of New Zealand. And then I'm watching Willow, and I was like, Jesus Christ, they did it 13 years before Lord of the Rings.
They definitely did.
Oh my God, this is all... Yeah. It's the same shit.
They're absolutely, you know, in good and bad ways, it's 100% ripping off from Lord of the Rings.
You know,
there's hobbits. You know, and even the sort of hobbitish society of the haughty, still short people who are slightly taller than the other short people. Yep. Like, all of that is right out of Tolkien, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And the other thing that I think it gets right, and the reason that I'm... probably, I think you feel more affection for the movie, is the score, which, oh boy, does it ever presage the Avatar score.
Yep.
Horn, the little horn things are exactly the same. It's the exact same.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
James Horner was notorious for copying his own
just reusing
and beats.
Yeah.
Willow is one of the only ones where it is completely fully formed. You know, he wasn't really playing with anything he'd done before. He obviously pillaged it later.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, that score on its own as a piece is just fucking incredible.
Yeah.
Like, wall to wall. Yeah. Incredible. Brings tears to my eyes every time I hear it.
Yeah.
It was actually the first thing I listened to after James Horner died.
So, because there are not a lot of films that have direct Ebert involvement, this was my choice.
Sure, yeah.
I do think it's funny to me that the solution to killing the Ebersisk is stabbing one of them through its mouth until its head explodes.
That's right.
For not being able to talk.
Yeah, it can't open its mouth, so its head literally blows off.
Yeah.
And then the other one can't survive without it. That's the interesting thing for the Ebert parallel. Yeah, the other one can't survive without it, which proved to be not true.
Right. But they thought, kill one, and
Yeah, weird foreshadowing there. You have one die before the other, but also you have one lose its voice. And that kills it.
Yeah.
Weird.
Then you chose, I think, a more...
Well, I went to the obvious, which is...
On the nose.
Which is, like you said, it's very difficult to make a list for this show about a film critic.
Right, unless you start counting films he liked, or...
So that said, I do have to say that I'm more proud than usual of the list that I put on our Letterboxd page, which is at letterboxd.com/deathwatchpod for Ebert, because I came up with like 15, 16 movies
that
he really supported, like Do the Right Thing,
Hoop Dreams.
Yeah. Or that meant a lot to him personally, like Synecdoche, New York.
Can I ask, was Gates of Heaven on there?
Gates of Heaven was not on there. That's probably an omission.
It should probably go on there.
I didn't have any Errol Morris on there. That's a good call. But you know, so like just some notable reviews of his, but then the obvious one is that he actually did co-write a movie back in 1970. He wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls for Russ Meyer, and I had not seen the movie, and as with many things, I had somehow hoped to one day do it. So
have
it
you
like,
seen
this is the chance
Valley of the Dolls?
I have not seen.
Interesting. Valley now, not that you have to, because it's not a sequel. But
no, and it tells you that right off the top.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was one of those things where here's a kind of movie that I really like, movie experience that I really like. Is the movie where for probably 75% of it, the first 75%, I don't think I like it very much, and then I realize that I actually love it. These happen to me every now and again. This was one of those things. It was not that I wasn't enjoying the first 75%, but I was like kind of like, you know, ah, whatever. And I was like looking at my phone every now and again and stuff like that. And then I sort of, and there wasn't like a specific incident in the film. It was just right. At some point I kind of finally tuned exactly into its brainwave. And I was like, oh, this is fucking great.
Yeah, it takes a while.
This is fucking great.
It definitely has a much stronger, bottom third.
Sure.
When it actually develops a plot of some kind, and then, you know, there's a reason.
Yeah,
It's the things I like about it, I think, come from Ebert, which is that there's the kind of a naughty sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
But there's also a relentlessly, like, now, I think at the time it was somewhat innovative, the sort of really choppy editing style that he's got, and the cutaways, and there's this sort of like off balance approach to the editing, which they say in the extras is because he used so many non actors that it's the only way he would basically cut around performances.
Oh, that's interesting. So one of the things that I assume, because he also does, there's a lot of montage scenes in the film.
Yeah, and the same thing.
And one of the things that I noticed was that anytime there was anything even resembling nudity or the suggestion of sex, it's actually there on the screen.
Yeah.
But it's on the screen for like a half a second.
Like, yeah.
Boink,
yeah.
And then it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, I was wondering if that was kind of a strategy to make the movie seem less dirty than it was.
Or to make it seem more dirty than it was, is I think more likely. To give you the sense that you were actually seeing more full frontal stuff.
Yeah.
But the thing is, because Meyer came up through, you know, exploitation films. He has an interesting backstory. So he came up as a war photographer.
Yep.
He took all the footage of Patton.
Oh, cool.
In the theater of war. So he was trained by the same people that I don't think he was trained directly by Ford and those guys, but they hired the guys that trained these cameramen, and they were, you know, they learned to shoot in crazy conditions in the middle of World War II, and then, you know, he always wanted to make films, and so. His entree into it obviously was through exploitation films, and he just developed his style because he worked with so many actors who couldn't, you know, deliver lines or reliably like hold a prop and deliver a line at the same time, that he just started to cut this crazy way until he decided he liked it.
Yeah.
So I think by the time Beyond the Valley of Dolls comes along, he's working with enough professional actors. He probably didn't need to do that.
Maybe.
They're not all great.
In this movie can pull it off.
They're not all great, but they're not. But they're able to say their lines.
Sure.
But he's still cutting the same way around everyone.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that style is very, like, reminds me of sort of Laugh-In and a lot of other sort of late 60s, early 70s, like, there's a certain aesthetic around the late 60s of a lot of, like, unnatural feeling camera movements and unnatural feeling editing that I just don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously tied into whatever associations I have with when I first started. I think it's just personal to me, but I find that very off-putting. And I don't know if that... Does that resonate for you? Like, I just... rhythms just feel wrong to me.
Yeah, I think if you felt that way, that wouldn't work for you. But, I mean, that never put me out of a movie. And as it goes along, especially... So, I mean, spoilers for
being... I mean, I feel the same way about the first, you know, half hour of Moulin Rouge. Like, I just don't like...
Yeah, it's hard to get used to.
Yeah.
Spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. The last event in the movie is this insane murder spree at this one guy's house.
Yeah.
Which is, I wrote in my notes, it anticipates that really good episode of Atlanta from 2 weeks ago, because it just pivots hard into horror out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, you think you're watching a comedy, and it's like, oh, Jesus, what is this? But, you know... With that being there, and being that this thing came out, like, you know, months after the Manson murders, is parodying a film that was supposedly this expose of Hollywood excess and the danger of this lifestyle, but it's doing it in this weird, like, bubblegum pop sort of way, instead of doing it, you know, self-seriously and melodramatically. This is a pretty subversive, almost confrontational piece of filmmaking, while still being very light and energetic and fun. Even the horror stuff is not like horrifying. No, it's just sort of thrill ride and stuff.
Yeah, there's blood in the movie that is clearly made of plastic.
Oh, of course,
like there's no
Yeah, absolutely. I just think that the movie coming out at the exact moment that it did is quite a totem for its time. Like I was just like, wow, this actually proves itself to be much more relevant than it probably was even trying to be at when Ebert was writing it. You know, it really is a specific moment in time.
Yeah.
That thing.
Yeah.
And in a very interesting way. So I found myself pretty engaged with it, and I just went to bed that night with a big stupid grin on my face. I was just like, wow, what the hell did I just, this is great. I love that movies like this exist.
It is, when you try to square it with who Ebert was and sort of his approach to reviews, it does seem strange. It really...
Well, there is one line, and I'm not the first person to make this connection, but this is something that he really stood by, which was the concept of, it isn't what a movie's about, it's how it's about it.
Yeah.
And that, there I get it, right? It's like, those are very deliberate choices to write this story for Russ Meyer to direct in the way that Russ Meyer directs.
Yeah.
I think that it's very knowing in that way. You know, like it is a very erudite...
And he had only been
of the ideas.
It's interesting because he had only been writing reviews professionally for like 2 years.
Yeah.
When he decided when he took this job, and he clearly took it because it was a job. I don't think he took it because he had this burning, you know, ambition around becoming a filmmaker or anything like that.
Yeah.
It all sounds to me like it was like summer vacation in Hollywood, and I'll write this movie, and you know.
Yeah, no, but I don't think it's quite that laid back, because I do think the thing about Ebert that maybe goes to his character a little bit more is that just relentless, like, first of all, slight arrogance. Like, let's be realistic. The guy really thought a lot of himself.
Yeah.
But also relentless curiosity and interest in figuring out how things work. Right? So I think if Russ Meyer comes to him, and they were friends at that point, and comes to him and says, I need someone to write this screenplay, I think he would have been like, I mean, I want to see what that is.
And I need
like
someone who's not already inside the machine, because we're going to make fun of it.
Right. Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So yeah, so that's the connection to sort of a film critic writing it, is it's a critique of Hollywood culture.
Yeah.
You know, a gross sort of gloss on it.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing is, you know, none of the sort of the satirical elements, none of the parodies of human beings are remotely close to any real human beings.
No.
Like, in a way that is, it's fascinating.
Yes.
To the Lance or whatever, the guy who's sort of like the beefcakey guy. I'm like, that's not what a real beefcakey guy looks
like.
No. It's not even close.
No, it's crazy. You
know? Yeah.
But the guy that John Lazar plays, well, I mean, he's unrealistic.
Z.
He's unrealistic in one way, because he turns out to be a transsexual, and it's a very odd...
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Very strange pivot. Apparently, they basically made that up on the day. Like,
that wasn't in the screenplay. That he likes to dress as ladies?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that he also was, you know, mid-op transgender, because he had breasts.
Right.
You know? That is a very strange moment in the movie. But that character... You know, that seemed to me kind of more grounded in, like, the Phil Spector style, like, Hollywood personality.
But do you think, I mean, I don't know whether he had talked about it later. It also struck me as being, you know, maybe the plot device that doesn't, you know, it's probably not a good idea.
Maybe.
In the long run, to feed into that trope.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think there are plenty of things about the movie that are very progressive. For its time.
Yeah, there's a female lead.
Yeah, there's a female lead. There's
an all-girl rock band.
Yeah, there's an African-American couple.
Yeah, and the woman in that couple has agency and, like, is making the choices.
Yeah.
Yes, there's...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's lots of stuff like that that's ahead of its time. There is certainly, you know, it's very behind its... Well, not...
Yeah, ways you could argue that he's a feminist, right?
But, yeah, but it is of its time in terms of its treatment of the trans character, for sure. And again, like you said, that trope that the gay character basically goes crazy,
or that gay characters are lustful for murder.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely
a part of being gay.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, for sure. But you know, I don't know. I mean, I actually didn't find anything by him, you know, refuting any of the work. I don't think he ever... It's not that he didn't take it seriously, but he kind of almost, in the way he talked about it, never let it be taken too seriously.
Yeah.
You know, like, he would guard against coming down too hard on it by just sort of being like, okay, this is obviously ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, this was purposefully ridiculous.
And was made because they had the rights to a movie called Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
And off they went.
And they tried with Jacqueline Suzanne to write that movie for quite a number of times. Mm-hmm. And nothing she wrote was any good.
Right.
And then they went, fine, fuck it. Just let's let Russ Meyer do this instead, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
This was an instead.
Yes.
This what they wanted was a sequel that had the same characters in it.
For sure. Yeah. And I just think, I mean, I haven't seen the original. Now I will. I just think it's one of the great digressions in, you know, Hollywood filmmaking. Is that this?
It's hard to believe it is a Hollywood film. Yeah. Like, this is one of those movies when you see there's an actual logo in front of it, you're like, really?
Yeah.
That's very strange. This is
absolutely the fallout of
the collapse of Easy Rider studios.
Yeah. No studio bankrolls this unless Easy Rider has just come out and made a fucking
ridiculous amount. And they have no idea. And also, all of their finances suck and nobody knows what's going to happen. They're all going to,
Great. So the only, I mean, you know, we've discussed this on our other show and maybe we can't get into it in too much detail here, but I mean, I think the real, one of the things that's worth asking, you know, we've talked in the past about the death of movies and the death of film criticism. You know, I've sort of always had this eerie feeling when Ebert died that sort of an era just ended right there.
Yeah.
You know, that there was a beginning, middle, and an end for the relationship between criticism and movies, and that death was the end. Doesn't mean there will never be another good film critic or another good film review written, but I just think that time is past now.
Well, I think what has really passed is the idea that there can be authority.
Mm.
Yes, indeed. And an authoritative voice that is worth listening to.
Right.
I think we have actually democratized that out of existence. I don't think that's a good thing, but I think that is what's happened.
Yeah.
You know, the rise of the idea of fake news, the idea that any fact you don't like, you can simply dismiss as an untrue, not fact, means it's, who are we turning to for their expertise? You know, why would we turn to anyone? No one can be trusted. They're all, you know, the groundswell of anger at film reviewers for disliking something people want everyone to like I'm thinking of the pretty poisonous DC fans or whatever, that is in lockstep with fake news, with the political dismissal of authority. I sound like a very old man now. Well, there should be more authority. Yeah. You know, like I don't mean it like that, but I just
think... No, but it's very true.
There's, you know, there's, in order for Ebert to be the authoritative voice, first one has to accept that there can be an authoritative voice.
Yeah.
And then decide who's going to fill that role. You know, and if we've now cast that off, how could someone come along? How could anyone be a good enough writer to come along in the era when we simply don't accept that anyone can be that for us
anymore? Right. And that we, you know, we're weirdly angry. Well, not us, you and I are fine with it, but a lot of people are weirdly angry and insecure about even the presentation of an authoritative voice. Just even the idea of it angers them, puts them off. And I don't understand when that happened, you know, that idea that...
Well, I think partly what happened is that in any case where you pick any single voice, part of the anger will be that it doesn't represent enough other people or the specific other people who are upset about it not representing them.
Sure.
And there's nothing wrong with that. The you know, the lack of representation, the lack of inclusion, even the fact that Ebert was, you know, he's a white male, heterosexual. This is not, you know, he's not a pioneer in that respect.
Right.
That probably would have you know, been some a way to dismiss him for if he had come along now, enough people would have dismissed him on that basis of, look, we don't need another one of you guys.
Right.
Well, we need someone.
We need, you know, I mean, and as we've said before, any art form needs a stable body of critical thought to continue.
Yes.
As soon as it doesn't have that, it is a geriatric art form on its way to death. And I'm not shitting on the current state of critical thought, because there are a lot of really great things happening and there are a lot of really great writers, and you know, I don't think podcasts are inherently evil. Christ, I mean, we're doing one right now. But, you know, like, there's a degree to which that entire conversation seems to have been shuffled off to sort of a fan activity, and it shouldn't be. You know, this should not just be the domain of fans.
Yeah.
It shouldn't just be people who think movies are really cool who talk about movies. There should be some people who think of it on a higher level than that and have some ability to interact with it.
But it's also shuffled off into people who, for whom movies are an academic pursuit that has more to do with them proving certain points about the world the thing about Ebert that I so respect is that his writing is about the movies that he watched. It's not about how he can use a film to create a take on something about the world. It's about the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, to some degree, that has been completely lost. I don't think anyone's really writing in that way. It's impossible now to simply write in that way. You have to connect. You can't write a piece about film without connecting it to some social reality.
Yeah,
issue.
Absolutely.
And you know, and talk about its impact on or comment of or response to or response from. It's all that has to exist in your review, and that actually to me is antithetical to sort of the enjoyment of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was also, I mean, that's kind of what I'm talking about with that he democratized. His reviews were democratized in a way where, because of that, because there was no...
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there was an inherent political bias. There weren't tethers to other current events.
In Ebert? There's just a sort of a general humanism.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, like, that means that theoretically anyone could pick up one of his reviews, read it, and as much as our society has really moved away from this idea, I would argue his reviews were good at whether he had your opinion about a movie or not, his reviews were good at helping you determine whether or not you might like the movie.
Yeah.
Whether you agreed with him or not.
Yeah.
Whether you and him had the same taste.
Yeah, you at least would get a good sense of what the movie was like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, it seems so much to be a game of finding people who echo your general thoughts exactly.
Right.
That doesn't happen anymore, and very few people are even trying it. So the takes become sharper, and it becomes more about sort of shouting your opinion.
And having to grab the attention of people in a way that is almost unnatural, because you can no longer count on anyone actually consistently reading you.
Right.
So every film that comes out, the approach is, how can I use this towards the end of getting people to pay attention to me?
Right.
And that's not interesting.
No.
You know.
No, it's not. Anyway, we came here to eulogize Roger Ebert. Maybe we came to eulogize film criticism itself.
And movies.
And
altogether.
The human race, really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
But
we were meant to come from here. We were never meant to die here.
We were never meant to die here. Yeah, we both have Interstellar large in our heads. So that's our Roger Ebert episode. As I mentioned earlier, for May we're going to be doing Isao Takahata.
I am so excited about.
Yeah, I'm going to watch Grave of the Fireflies. You also watch that, but you also watch
My film is Pompoko. So get out there and watch Pompoko.
Yeah.
We do this show from Toronto, and Pompoko is about raccoons, which
we get it.
A Toronto thing, and it's I can't wait.
Yeah.
To talk about it.
Now that said, you know, as we after roll call, I mentioned that a lot of heavy hitters passed away in just the last few weeks. That may continue to happen. You know,
we may have to switch gears.
Yeah. I mean, this is a monthly show, so I long ago had to accept that we're not even going to create a consistent canon of who we cover. There's not going to be a consistent level.
No.
You know, like, we're just going to pick somebody.
Nor is this a syllabus. You don't have to.
Yeah.
There's no getting to the end of this and being like, well, now I know about everything.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
It's very random.
Yeah. So, like, for example, I was really excited about doing Stephen Bochco. I don't think we're going to have the time or opportunity to do it, but I'm still going to watch some Hill Street Blues, and who knows, maybe we'll have a quiet May and he'll be June. Like, we
guys,
just don't.
Guys, get out there.
We don't know.
Download some episodes of Beverly Hills Bunts.
Yeah, there you go. but yeah, other than that, thank you very much for listening. You can leave comments at modernsuperior.com. You can tweet at us at DeathWatchPod. You can follow us on Letterboxd, also at DeathWatchPod. And we'll be back on the last Friday of May, which is the 25th. And I know that.
Oh, look at you doing research, because
I'm going to.
That is Star Wars Day.
It is Star Wars Day, and it is also the day that I'm going to Italy. So lots happening on May 25th, but there will be an episode, so you can listen to that.
Hey, we got through this whole show without mentioning my injury.
Yeah, you want to tell people about
how I fell down. Everything's fine, guys.
He fell down.
I fell down hard.
It was the worst thing I've ever seen. It was the worst. And literally, whenever I'm funny, he's in pain.
I'm in, yeah.
More so.
More pain than normal. Yes.
Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next month.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.